This podcast is brought to you by ORCHSE Strategies, an industry leader in developing innovative, sustainable approaches for protecting workers and the environment. And a big thank you for their sponsorship to the Pre-Accident Podcast. ORCHSE's main focus and passion is in fostering EH&S performance excellence in all their companies. When members participate in one or more of ORCHSE's 9 different specialized networks, or if they engage in one of their task force or working groups, something very special happens. The sharing of ideas frequently results in cutting-edge solutions that have practical applications immediately. For example, ORC has been at the forefront of efforts to create new approaches for fatal and serious injury prevention and has helped plan, conduct, and create conferences on human and organizational performance. If you're interested in learning more about the unique opportunities available through ORCHSE, please contact our buddy Linda Haney at 202-510-0509. Or if you'd rather pop her an email, it's linda.haney, L-I-N-D-A dot H-A-N-E-Y at ORCHSE.com. Now, let's listen to the podcast. Episode 100. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the 100th episode of the Pre-Accident Investigation Podcast. I'm your host. Oh, crud. I've forgotten my name. Oh, what is it? No. Rhymes with odd. Don't have it. Nope. Todd Conklin. That's my name. Here it is. This is it. 100. Now, really, since we every other episode do a safety moment, operational excellence moment, we're really kind of at 200, but let's push those aside for a moment. This is 100 full-blown interviewee episodes just for you, and this has been the most fun ride ever. I never would have imagined we'd have got to 100. I don't know what I thought, but I wasn't thinking 100. Now I'm kind of onto it. Now I'm thinking maybe we should go to 500. You know, maybe that's our next big goal. We've got about 200,000 listeners. I don't even know how many downloads because it's really hard to calculate. But we've got a lot of specific people that listen. And we've got a lot of people that have been on it. There's been about, believe it or not, almost 90 people interviewed from all walks of life in our world. People who care about stability, reliability, safety, security, surety, those kind of programs. People who work with pretty complex systems and really need to have pretty reliable outcomes. That's who listens to this podcast. You're going to love today's podcast because it's simple as pie. No big deal. I've just gone through and clipped out people who've been on the podcast throughout our journey. And I'm going to start early. You'll hear a clip of the very, very first podcast. That kind of kicks it off. And then we'll just sort of move through a bunch of clips from here to there. I'm really pleased with how this came out. It tells a story. And what's funny about this story is I didn't go through and listen to 100 episodes of the podcast. It's just like, I don't want to break it to you, but I don't read the books I write either because I wrote them. I didn't listen to the podcast because I was there. But I did go through and kind of randomly pick out quotes, snippets, little sound bites of people on the podcast. And I think you'll find this incredibly, incredibly entertaining. Much more entertaining than I imagined it would be. So listen carefully to this. But before we go there, let me thank you. Because this podcast would not exist, I promise you, would not exist had you not listened. Because if nobody listened, I could do this without recording it. I could do it all. I could do it on planes. I'd probably be asked to leave, but I could totally do the podcast on planes. The difference is that what's happened is we've all learned a lot. And if you ask me, that kind of pays its rent. The fact that every one of these clips has a little teachable moment that's randomly selected from podcasts, that's pretty interesting. In fact, I'd suggest that's really interesting. Back and enjoy. And thank you again for being a part of this. Let's not stop. In fact, why don't you give people this episode and have them listen to this episode to give them a pretty good understanding of what this podcast does? If they want to hear more, well, what the heck? Go back and pull them out of the archives. They're all on iTunes. If they want to start from here and move forward, that's cool too. But I think you're going to find this podcast about as interesting as any of the other podcasts, maybe a tiny, tiny bit more. So this, my friends, is the 100th episode of the Pre-Accident Podcast. And I'm saying to you, thank you. And the way I'm going to say thank you is by putting together this tiny little clip show. So sit back and enjoy. You're going to like this. Have fun. This is the maiden voyage, the first of hopefully many other podcasts to come. And it's an attempt to really expand the conversation around the new view of safety, human performance, and how systems influence behavior.
People are going to make mistakes. And when people do make mistakes, we want to have a system that's robust enough that they fail softly when we know they're going to fail. And I'm not sure we're there yet as a company, but we've got the right people thinking about that concept now around the world, and I think that's an important thing. So it's about human fallibility, human error, and how we manage that within our system.
Organizations are neurotic, right? And it's a matter of continuing to work on those areas where we have conflict and neurosis and dysfunction in order to become better.
And Heinrich was wrong that you can reduce the small ones and you'll get to the large ones necessarily in the same motion. That is not correct.
If you remember in the early days for both of us, I think back of how I must have explained things and how I must have talked about different graphs and stuff, and I kind of laugh because I wonder what the heck I even said. But I think what most people, it sounds good. It really does sound good. And I think it is good. But it's not nearly as easy to implement as you would think.
Right, the transition from going to seeing people as the problem to control, right, to seeing them as a very important part of the solution that organizations need to embrace and harness, that was a new language. I recall about 4 years ago when we came to Australia, we gathered a bunch of thinkers around this in a room, but it was almost like a smoke-filled room where we sunk in oaken shadows and huddled, you know, and with closed doors and whispered the words of safety heresy.
So all of a sudden, they were like faulty components in the system. They were bad and broken people because it was clearly their error that resulted in this terrible, terrible outcome. And I thought that just wasn't enough. It left me completely disquieted. There was a constant uneasiness about it.
With safety issues, what there could be a temptation to do is to go into a problem or into an event, whether it's, you know, a general series of events, whether it's a specific event, to go into it with an assumption of what really happened, what were the underlying causes. And then you're going to start collecting data and build models that essentially confirm the prejudices that you went into the analysis with.
The average health and safety person has their plate full. They're trying to deal with the quote-unquote health and safety problems, and they're not even aware of where the major operational issues are and problems that are really challenging, you know, workers and supervisors and the rest, and dramatically increasing risk, because obviously we know that hazards and risks are dynamic, and we know that these operational changes and challenges are creating some new hazards and certainly intensifying risk.
I was constantly looking at it from that perspective. So I had to balance both pieces, not just the hand on the switch, the hand on the valve, or the piece of equipment, or the scaffolding, or the throttle, but what in that system drove that individual to do what they did and have it make sense to them at the time.
There are medical and logistical issues that come up that we're always able to tweak. And then there's the issues that you really can't put your hands on. They're more, I'm blanking out on the word, but it's that part of the process that keeps us a family. We always have the pharmacy there. We always have nursing. We always have anesthesia, which in this case is me, who's showing up. And it just reinforces the fact that, hey, we did a great thing. The patient did well. There's a few things we got to tweak. But, you know, what we have developed over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, hey, it's working well. We did something really good a week ago. The patient's left the hospital. She left with a healthy baby. And I think it's important for those people on the team to have a positive reinforcement and a positive self-image of what they're doing, that what they're doing makes a difference.
You know, what this is all about, whether it's resilience engineering or normal accidents, I don't care what, it's vulnerability. And we're dealing with ambiguous information, which means that you and I can look at the same information and come to different conclusions, which means that your plans don't work.
I'm sorry, but it's perhaps the lawyer inside of me, because that goes back to sort of sense of duty. And if we have a sense of duty, you know, human beings, we're going to do the right thing. And you know, you can say, you know, can you count on me? And the answer is, well, we'll see, right? I mean, ultimately, you're looking at it after the fact and saying, okay, you know, we designed that good system. How has the employee performed within this system?
I have no problem calling right now, but I have to say I'm actually following up on a small crisis. There's this bomb threat in one of our main museums in Antwerp, and we're still deciding whether we're going to evacuate or not. So just telling you this before we start the podcast, so if I break up the line, you know why it is.
Out of that thinking, we get a very comfortable story, right? Well, we found the culprit. It's this person. It's this man or woman. And then everybody's happy, you know, the person is punished, and it feels like justice is restored. But then when we really think about it, it's like, okay, well, like, how is it possible that this person was actually able to kind of, that this outcome could come anyway, right?
Right.
And what if we put a different person in that place? Would we never have this outcome? Can we guarantee that it will never happen again? And it's that discomfort that then leads us deeper into like the systemic issues that are there, right, that we're all trying to uncover.
Or they start ignoring you and go, wow, you've been banging on about this for 18 months and there's been a little bit of change but not enough big change. So I'm hearing a bit of that around the traps. We've seen some small change and that's really good, but there's not enough big change. People are getting impatient, which is good because people go, hey, we want this. We want some change. This is really good. They're really recognizing it. But the small experiment, and I don't think by big change they mean stop small experiments. We need to keep those, but we probably need to do some bolder stuff.
I mean, I'm not saying it won't happen, but it does happen. I will say this. I did get the best compliment where I'm at right now that I've ever gotten in my life. Got done with doing an all-employee meeting, and kind of we were talking. I mean, it was right when I first got here, so we were talking about risk and how you evaluate that using pre-jobs, things of that nature. After the meeting, this guy came up to me and he said, out of everybody who sat in that office, you made it the most digestible.
You know, your perspective, which I agree with, is the goal of doing investigations is to learn and improve. And I've thought about that a lot, and I think it's, you know, I think it's good and I like it. And I was thinking in terms of if I were a manager, what else would I want to get out of this? And I think, and this is just me, I think we want to move towards foresight.
Yeah, that's a very provocative question because, you know, everybody's so used to the standard metrics of,
right,
you know, the recordables and the lost time. And, you know, everybody wants to put a number on things. And to be quite frank, I've had to specifically say, we don't always have to have numbers. We can have program goals, just like, you know, making sure we've trained people on the new view, that we've trained them on learning teams, that we've, you know, actively engaged existing champions to become learning team facilitators, that maybe we, you know, have other program kind of goals to help us measure our successes.
Yeah, no, I would say the way that I would see the world is the way that the hurdler sees the hurdle in the 110-meter hurdle race. So for the hurdler to be most efficient and run the fastest time and have the greatest chance of winning, the hurdler needs to get as close as possible to that hurdle without obviously knocking it over. If the hurdler jumps too high over the hurdle, then he slows down and he's inefficient and he's going to lose. And so I think in organizations, what we have done in the past is we've asked workers to clear the hurdle at a greater height.
We need to have a balance between planning the job to reduce the number of incidents and executing the job with a plan that incidents are going to occur. Let's manage the consequence of failure.
So this is well understood, but instead we have people running around giving talks about how if people just tried harder and were more careful, this would go away. Well, that's not science. That's not how this works. That's not the, you know, that doesn't actually change things for the better. It doesn't reduce the problem.
Yes and no. When you use the word culture in that general sense, you're in a sense missing the point that my example illustrates how there are two different cultures clashing with each other. The culture from the executive point of view of the nuclear plant says it's obvious that safety is our top values. But down in the plant, among the unionized employees, there is a superseding occupational value that says we don't rat on each other.
I will tell you this, awkward. I am so happy with where we're at and the journey that we're on. And, you know, the thing I wonder a lot when I lay in bed is how many people already have been kept from getting hurt seriously. Now, we're not perfect, Todd, and that's what I do hate sometimes. I don't want anybody to think we don't have our sine waves and ups right. and downs. And the other thing, and you mentioned it, and I didn't know where you were going, at least on the generation side, you know, the directors, you've worked with every one of them.
Right.
I think you would say, too, they don't go through it because they have to because they work for this company. They believe it.
What do you think? 25 people, I think, if I got it right. Let me list them for you. Steve D'Albuquerque, Martha Acosta, Tom Krause, Shane Bush, Sidney Decker, Ivan Popolitti, Robert Holmes, James Howell. Jim Howell, why'd they call him James? It's I'm thinking formal now. Rob Fisher, Alan Frankfurt, David Van Straelen, David Marks, Bert Brueggemann, Dave Zwieback, Tanya Palmer, Frank Dunlap, Bill Rigo, Lincoln, Marcy, Frazier. Oh, now I'm being now I'm too informal. Steve Scott, David Woods, Ed Schein, Barry Boswell, and if I missed anybody, I meant to read it. It's a pretty good list of people. I mean, that's quite a crowd, and this has been quite a podcast. I can't tell you. I guess I can because I am telling you. This has been a really fun ride for me. And the crazy thing about it is I've learned so much. You know, I started this as kind of a goof. It was a bet that was made in my front yard one summer day where the initial premise was that I should have a YouTube channel. And I don't know. I mean, I didn't YouTube. What I told them when they asked me to have a YouTube channel is I said, I don't look that good without a shirt on. And they said, well, you know, you don't have to be naked on a YouTube channel. And I said, well, then why would you be on a YouTube channel? But the conversation sort of threaded over to maybe a podcast. And I've been listening to podcasts for years. In fact, I'm a big podcaster, partially because I travel on planes a lot. And before that, I commuted quite a ways. And I had to kind of stop listening to the news because the news was really making me depressed and crazy. I'm pretty sure you understand exactly what that feels like after this election. And so I started thinking, well, I'm going to do some stuff. So I learned Spanish for a couple of years. That was really fun. Muy, muy divertido. And then I decided to actually try podcasting, and I listened to it. And that kind of kicked off this podcast, and that's kind of where this all began. It sort of started with a goofy little podcast that was recorded just to see if people could become better. And what we've learned has been really amazing. And the journey has been really amazing. And I'm glad you've been a part of it. This is the 100th episode of the Pre-Accident Podcast, recorded especially for you, just you. It's just you and me. There's only the two of us and the tons of other people that listen. Thanks for listening. Subscribe. Tell your friends. There'll be 100 more at least, I'm guessing. I mean, we're going to go for it. There's really no need to stop now. If you want to be on it or be a part of it, drop me a line, toddconklin@gmail.com. It's that easy. Until then, learn something new every single day. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes, be safe.
She called me Mr. Bombastic, fairly fantastic. Put me on my box, she says I'm Mr. Romantic. Call me fantastic, put me on my box, she says I'm Mr. Smooth.
Oops, wrong button. Humans are fallible. For goodness sakes, be safe.